Krecker aimed the bloody pipe at the boy.
How about you, then?
Dean raced over to take a seat in the gore-splattered chair. He looked very, very happy as the Rousty cinched him down. Krecker put a hand on the boy's shoulder.
I promise to try to do a neater job of it this time.
Doc hung back at poolside while the others started back down the hill with the empty cart. When they were out of sight, he slogged over to where Ryan had dropped his long blaster. He pulled the Steyr from the mud and used his frock coat to wipe some of the dirt from the barrel, scope, and stock. The weapon had gone in muzzle first, so he had to assume the bore was blocked. There was no time to clear it, and he had nothing to clear it with. He slung the bolt-action rifle over his shoulder and hurried down the trail. By the time he caught up, they were lining up in front of the burn barrel to get another ration of the wormy chow. His own stomach growling, Doc carefully hid the Steyr against the wall at the far end of the blockhouse. As the old man walked across the square to join the others, the carny master climbed on the bloody chair and banged on its arm with the metal cudgel to get everyone's attention. Doc had hoped that the chilling was over for the day. He had counted on having the entire night to work out a plan for getting his companions away from the gruesome horror of this hellhole. But it wasn't to be. The red-haired carny master announced a coup d'etat and proclaimed himself Baron. Looking at the man, Doc had no doubt that he had dispatched the former ruler personally. But it didn't matter who was Baron. The agenda was the same. Doc's heart leapt into his throat when the new headman said the pool wasn't satisfied and called for volunteers, of which there were plenty, including his own dear friends. Doc's window of opportunity was rapidly slamming shut. The simplest course of action was to break the spell of the pool, but he had tried that without success. There was nothing he could do to the companions themselves to snap them out of it, but their respective dazes seemed to wane at times. They appeared to be struggling against the reins. Their resistance had also ended with the paralysis that followed each spore fall. Their confusion had to be only temporary and maintained only by regular redosing with spores, and perhaps with the bounty. From the thunder and lightning coming over the ridge above, another downpour was imminent, as was another meal of fungal nodes. If Doc couldn't shake them out of their state, then he knew he only had one course left, and that was to try to chill whatever it was that lived in the pool. As he racked his brain to come up with something, the carny scout volunteered to sit in the chair. The black man was all smiles as he let himself be strapped down. It was difficult to tell for certain, but he seemed to have a change of heart when the first blow landed, and it didn't kill him outright. Lying in the dirt, he wasn't screaming words, he was just screaming. Doc had the feeling that the shock had awakened him at the last instant, more than a few instants too late. Tanner turned away from the mayhem and stared at the low concrete blockhouse. The blows were still sounding behind him when he started to put the whole thing together. He was fairly sure that for whatever reason, pre-dark whitecoats had created the pool and its ecosystem, and that they had done it from the ground up. He asked himself, why then had the laboratory been sited here, so far below the pool? Certainly it made more sense to build the lab next to the system they were studying. The whitecoats probably knew the danger and wanted to be a safe distance away, which offered support for the bioweapon hypothesis. But that wasn't the whole story. He could see that the laboratory was connected to the pool through the pipes at the base of the slope. As there were no pipes in evidence at the lakeside, they had to be in place under it. Could the whitecoats have used the pipes to sample the pool's contents? Doc thought that unlikely. A pipe 5 feet across was overkill for taking samples. As he examined the base of the hillside, he noticed two other structures that seemed artificial. The rounded humps looked like culverts that had been buried by rock and dirtfall. They were twice as big as the blockhouse pipes. What was all the underground plumbing for? Was it because the whitecoats knew, even in the planning stages, the potential danger of the pool? Or did they want their fingers on the trigger of a fail-safe device that could deactivate or terminate the project? Doc finally had a clue as to the function, if not the exact construction of the device. It involved draining the lake above. He grimaced. It was all supposition, of course. As he started for the steps leading to the blockhouse entrance, the Rousties pulled Azimuth's body from the chair and pitched it into the cart. When he looked back, he saw a young Dean taking a seat in the death chair. It stopped him cold in his tracks.
By the three Kennedys!
Tanner broke into a run. He threw himself between the numbed spectators, trying to reach Dean and drag him free before harm could be done. Powerful hands roughly grabbed the old man by the arms and hurled him back. The crowd closed in tightly around the chair, effectively blocking another attempt on his part. Doc gripped the handle of his sword stick, but he didn't draw the blade. He knew he could skewer more than a few of the bodies before him, but he could never chill enough of them to free Dean in time. And he would have had to mortally stab his friends to rescue the boy. The scholar reversed course and sprinted across the square. He ran down the blockhouse steps and through its open door. As he ran, he ducked and dodged the dangling, rusting light fixtures. The smell of mildew and rot was almost overpowering. He charged into the first room he came to, skidding on the concrete floor. Before him was a row of squat, heavy-looking machines. They looked like pumps of some kind. In the dim light, he quickly examined them.
Yes!
They were definitely pumps. He located the starter switch on one of them and depressed it. Nothing happened. He tried the others with the same result. He kicked aside some of the debris from the fallen tile ceiling and saw the thick electrical cable on the floor. They were electrically powered. There was no generator in the room. The wall opposite the hallway was laced with rows of heavy pipe. He scanned the various dials and gauges set at intervals along the wall. Some had cracked faces and missing indicators. All the others read zero. The system was most definitely offline. Doc was slammed by a crushing sense of hopelessness. Without a blueprint or schematic, how was he ever going to figure it all out? He smothered the thought and moved on. If there was a generator in the building, he had to find it, and quickly. It wasn't in the next room he checked, but in the one after it. There was no mistaking it either. It was the size of four refrigerators, stacked one on top of the other. Doc located the ignition switch, pressed it, and got nothing. If there was a battery in the system, it was long dead. The pull start rope produced nothing. He found the generator's gas tank and discovered that it was empty.
Hell's fire!
Doc just knew that white coats sitting on a biological time bomb wouldn't leave themselves only one way to deactivate it. They wouldn't completely depend on electrical power that could be shut off at a critical moment by any number of mechanical failures. There had to be a more direct method. He thought about the lake above and the pressure of thousands of tons of water. Perhaps the deactivation system was gravity-powered. Perhaps it could use the water pressure to physically or hydraulically move a barrier out of the way. Doc rushed on. Now that he had a clue of what he was looking for, he wasted no time on the offices. The last room had more of the squat pumps, and the pipes along its wall were much bigger in diameter. When he saw the red steel wheel and the sign above it, he knew he'd found the drain plug. The wheel was part of a massive valve set in a bend in the thick pipe. The peeling red-on-white sign was stained with rust, but it was still legible. It read, "Extreme danger, emergency use only. System test and certification required every 30 days. Secure escape route and evacuate all downstream personnel before operating valve." There was a dusty clipboard hanging on a hook below the valve. The faded top page was a maintenance record. It had been almost 100 years since the system had been checked and certified. Not that that mattered. It either worked or it didn't, and there was no way to evacuate anybody. Doc untwisted a loop of steel wire that locked the rim of the wheel to the valve. When he tried to turn the wheel, it wouldn't budge. He jammed his sword stick through the spokes and used it like a lever. The wheel moved an inch or two.
As my young colleague Dean would say, hot pipe!
Something popped, and the wheel started moving easily. He spun the valve open. The floor rocked violently.
My goodness, it sounds as though I have released Niagara Falls!
Water sounded as though it were rushing everywhere. Everything continued to shake and shake apart. Concrete dust streamed from the ceiling above him. He knew it was going to come down, and before he could reach the doorway, it did. Doc lost his grip on his sword stick as the debris buried him. Ryan the passenger watched from the wheelhouse of the SS Cotter as Baron Krecke beat the scout's head to a pulp. He was standing close enough to be hit by brains and blood. He could feel it dripping down the side of his face, but he couldn't make his hand move to wipe it away. Flashes of green lit the slope above the vill. The sky started to spit a few tentative spores. It was coming again, he knew. The pool was about to reestablish control over its slaves. Rand forced his fingers to move. A twitch was all he could muster, but it was a start. Then Krekka called for another volunteer, and Dean stepped forward. Ryan wanted to cry out a warning, but couldn't. His hands closed into fists at his side.